many years ago, we were looking to redesign Facebook, but a lot of people wrote in and were like, wow, you changed this thing. I don't like it. Bring back old Facebook.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Famous Failures. I'm your host, Ozan Barol. Today's guest on the show is Julie Zhu. Julie is the Vice President of Product Design at Facebook. As one of Silicon Valley's top product design executives, Julie leads the teams behind some of the most popular web and mobile services used by billions of people around the world. She writes about technology, design, and leadership on her popular blog, which is called The Year of the Looking Glass, as well as in publications like the New York Times and Fast Company. Her new book, which just came out last week, is called The Making of a Manager, What to Do When Everyone Looks at You, and it's available wherever books are sold. In the interview, Julie and I discuss how she became a manager at Facebook when she was just 25 years old, the most valuable failures she experienced as a manager and what she learned from them, three strategies that Julie uses to cope with imposter syndrome, how managers can create an environment where team members are willing to share their mistakes and failures, the importance of saying, I don't know, particularly if you're a manager, what you should consider in building a support network for yourself, how to stay in what Julie calls the discomfort zone, and why the best results don't come from fear. Before I play the interview, if you're interested in keeping in touch with me, you can sign up for the Weekly Contrarian, which is my weekly email newsletter that goes out to nearly 13,000 subscribers every Thursday morning. And it shares an article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations for books, other articles I enjoyed, tools, quotes, really anything that helps challenge conventional wisdom in some fashion. I include content on there that I don't include anywhere else, including on my blog. So I hope you'll check it out. You can sign up for that by going to weeklycontrarian.com and just dropping in your email address. You can also text my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345, and you can sign up for that way as well. And if you do sign up, you'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Julie Zhu. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Thank you, as always, for listening. Julie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm so excited to speak with you as well. I actually struggled a little bit trying to figure out how to kick things off here because you've got such an interesting background, but I decided in the end to just start in the middle, right in the thick of it. And we can always circle back to the beginning if the opportunity permits itself. But I want to go back to when you were 25 years old, you're working at Facebook and you're asked to become a manager. So can you take us back to that moment when you were offered the position? Maybe give us some context about what Facebook was like at the time and what you were doing for them and describe what that conversation was like?
Absolutely. So even to back up slightly more, I joined Facebook right out of college. Facebook was a startup at the time. You know, it's one of those companies where mom's like, what are you doing? Are you sure you want to join that? It was a college website, you know, very popular, about maybe 8 million users were using it. It had just opened up to high schoolers, but that was its core, you know, demographic, its core competency. And I had used Facebook in college, you know, so I knew it quite well. My friends, all of us quite loved it. And so that's how I knew about it. And, you know, it happened to be very close to where I was living at the time. And I had some friends there and they recommended that I join. So I joined as Facebook's first intern. Imagine, you know, I walk in, everyone, you know, there's Daft Punk music playing. It's a startup, right? So again, people, you know, we're there and everyone's like wearing many hats, working on many problems. I joined as an engineer, but even on day one, someone was like, oh, you know Photoshop? Okay, we need you to go and do some design work. Here's where some of the designers sit. Like, good luck, figure it out. So that was the environment, you know, at the time. And so, you know, I did a lot of engineering work in those first few years. I eventually also did a lot of design work. You know, again, people were playing multiple roles, so this was not at all unusual. And the design team was quite small when I joined, but a couple of years later, about 3 years later, and this is, you know, what you're getting to, I was 25.
And if I can stop you right there just for a moment. So what does design work look like at Facebook?
Yes. So design work, it means that we create the experiences that you see as a user. And so we decide, you know, what is the structure of the page? What's the information hierarchy? How big is the type size going to be? You know, how will this feature work? You know, what buttons are you going to press? Like, what's the icon that you're going to see that is going to, you know, tell you this particular information? So in essence, we're basically architecting, you know, the experience that you will have as a user when you come to interact with our product.
So with that background, we can then transition back into the story.
Great. So our design team was growing, and I was doing lots of different design work projects, had worked on profile, I had worked on, you know, newsfeed, which again, very, very new product for us at the time. And my manager sat me down and she said, you know, Julie, our team is growing. We're growing really rapidly. You know, things are going well. That's exciting. And we're going to need another manager to support all of these new designers that are joining. And, you know, you really get along with everyone. So what do you think? Will you, you know, be a manager? So that was a conversation. I was really excited. I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, this is like me winning the lottery. This is like me getting the ticket to Hogwarts. You know, this is the start of a long and fulfilling career, you know, where I'm going to go and like climb the corporate ladder. And I said yes on the spot. But later I was reflecting, I was like, well, okay, I do get along with everyone on the team, but surely that is not, like, there's way more to the management job. And I realized I didn't really know what the job entailed. And I honestly didn't know if I was cut out for it, you know? And so I started to feel a lot of this, what is this going to be? Like, am I prepared? You know, like, I kind of feel like an imposter. And I was sort of then instantly thrust into having to deal with a lot of situations that I've never faced before. I think that's the same journey that basically all new managers go through, right? You know, you're put in lots of unfamiliar places, experiences, you know, situations involving other people. And that's where it all began.
So the imposter syndrome, I'm glad you mentioned it because it's such a ubiquitous feeling. Many of us struggle with it. I wonder, was this the first time you struggled with the imposter syndrome or did you have some experience with it before?
Oh, no, I had plenty of experience with it before. I mean, I felt that way when I decided to major in computer science at my university. You know, computer science is not a major with a lot of women. Often I was the only person in the room who was female. And I think that anytime you are a minority or you feel like, hey, everyone else is acting this way or, you know, projecting like they have a lot of confidence and they know what they're doing, you know, like I think very common to kind of, you know, maybe doubt yourself or to ask if you have what it takes. I remember hearing the term imposter syndrome for the first time in a college lecture. And I remember fist pumping me like, oh my gosh, that really, really describes a lot of like my experience and how I felt. And so, yeah, this was something that I had experienced before.
Amanda Palmer, who is a singer and author, she wrote The Art of Asking. She calls the imposter syndrome the fraud police. This is an imaginary, terrifying force of real grown-ups who are going to come, you know, knock on your door and tell you that you are a complete fraud. You don't know what you're doing. We're taking everything away and then we're going to tell everybody. So I love the way she describes it. Given that you've experienced the imposter syndrome, like many of us, a few times at least in your life, if you were giving advice to someone who was feeling like an imposter, who felt like, you know, they're offered a promotion at work and they feel like they're not cut out for the position, what strategies would you share with them or what would you tell them?
Yeah, I think the first is just acknowledging that this is normal. And, you know, I think every time we feel that way, we feel like we're the only one, right? Because that's what the feeling is. You know, you feel like you're the only one who's acting like you know what you're doing and everyone else around you knows what they're doing. And the reality of the situation is that actually a lot of people feel that way and we feel it in different contexts. And, you know, there are some things that we've done over and over again that, you know, again, we're very confident, we're very experienced in, but there's some things that are new and there's always going to be situations that feel unfamiliar that we haven't yet mastered. And it is okay and it is common to feel that way, but knowing that everyone feels that way, I think is the first step, right? Is recognizing that this isn't just unique to you, it is universal. The second thing, and I think this matters so much, is to find a support network of people that you trust, that you feel like you can be real with, that you can admit, you know, that you don't maybe have the answers or, yeah, you know, I'm feeling like maybe, you know, I'm not cut out for this. Because what is also so helpful in those situations is to hear other people say, look, you're not alone and, you know, you're great and we got your back and you know, by the way, like, this is just a part of like how things go. And sometimes when we feel like, you know, that imposter syndrome so deeply, we're not necessarily seeing clearly, right? We're maybe not giving ourselves enough credit for the things that we are great at, or maybe, you know, we assume everyone else thinks that we don't know what we're doing, but they actually have a very positive impression of us. So having a support network of people, you know, like third parties who can both help support you, but also help ground you and give you that perspective is hugely, hugely helpful. It's also okay sometimes to admit that you don't have all the answers and to ask for other people's help. I think the problem sometimes with imposter syndrome is we feel like, oh my gosh, we have to come across like we know everything, that we're the experts and we're playing this role. But there's a lot of power in being able to tell someone, you know, if they ask you a question. And I made this mistake a lot when I became a new manager. I felt like I had to come off like I knew it. And later on, when I realized that I didn't always have to do that, that if someone said, hey, Julie, here's this new idea, you know, I really want to do this, what do you think? I didn't have to say yes or no. And like, here's exactly, you know, here's my confident opinion. I could say, you know, I don't know. And let's talk about a little bit more, or let's go and, you know, ask a couple other people for their input, or even just, I need a little bit more time to process this. And those are all tactics that I think actually build more trust with other people, because again, you're not pretending and you're not, you know, trying to be something you're not. You're actually coming across more sincerely, more authentically, and that builds a stronger connection with other people.
Absolutely. Those three words, I don't know, are so rarely uttered, but as you so well described, they're so important to say, because you're also putting yourself out there and showing your vulnerability as well, when, especially as a manager, you already have credibility by virtue of your position. But if you're able to come out and say to someone who's on your team, like, you don't have all the answers, I think that probably makes you more relatable too in their eyes, because you're not this know-it-all person.
Yes. And I think if you come across like everything is always figured out, that you have all the answers, then I found that other people feel like they have to do that too. You know, that creates distance, right? So if I come off like I'm the manager who knows everything, who's super buttoned up, then my report feels like they have to act like everything in their world is going fine and they know what they're doing. And I found that sometimes that actually makes it hard for the other person to admit when they're struggling and they want your help. And, you know, if you ask all managers, you know, like, hey, would you rather know whether someone, you know, or whether a project isn't going well, or whether someone, you know, is thinking or feeling underwater, or, you know, whether, you know, every manager would say, absolutely, I'd want to know, right? I want to know the truth. I'd want to know so I can go and help that person. But it's a two-way street. So if you're not the one doing that as well to your report, you're not going to get that kind of trust and that vulnerability in return.
Absolutely. I also want to circle back to the second point you mentioned, which is about the support network, which I think is so important, not just in dealing with imposter syndrome, but also just with failures as well. And I'm seeing this problem come up again and again. It's like we're living in this very connected world, but a lot of us are also feeling lonely. So I wonder how you built the support network for yourself. Like, are these your support network, when you think of them, are these people at work? Are they your family? Are they friends? What does that look like?
That's a great question, because I found that it's not actually just one group of people. It's helpful to have maybe multiple groups of people, each that have a particular relationship to you. So when I became a new manager and I was working in design, I found that it was extremely helpful to have a group of other design managers that I could talk to, you know, some of them not even at my company, or some of them at other companies, because those are the people who understood some of the unique challenges that the design discipline is facing. You know, we could talk about where we thought the trends in the industry were going. We could commiserate over, you know, how hard it was to hire, you know, sometimes, or, you know, we could also support and help each other in how do we talk about design and how do we have a productive relationship with maybe our engineering counterparts or our product management counterparts. But then, you know, I felt that it was also really, really helpful sometimes to just be able to talk about issues of scale or some of the challenges I was facing as my team was growing, you know, and there weren't that many other design managers who maybe had the exact same situation. And you know, sometimes I'd be closer to an engineering manager who had gone through that process because her team was 10 times bigger than mine. And I felt like it was really helpful to have, you know, a network of other managers, even if they didn't work in design, that I could talk to about some of the more universal challenges of being a good manager to your team and thinking about scaling, growing, hiring, and so forth. And then there are other things where, you know, sometimes just like, I felt extremely stressed today. I felt like I might have said something or done something. And those, you know, sometimes I'll even talk to a friend or my husband or someone who's, you know, not even in the work that I'm doing. And it helps to have people who maybe don't have all the full context, but then just can listen to you and to reflect on what they're hearing from you to help you sort through those things, right? And to me, that is sometimes what a great coach does, you know, is just they're a great listener. They ask you the right questions and they help you work through your issues by just talking through it. You know, they're not the ones giving you the answers. They're helping to guide and be there to support. So I found that it is really helpful to not get too caught up in the like, do I have the one person that can be everything to me, or do I have the one group of people? But to, you know, look at all of the things, all of the challenges that you have and find a couple people who can help with maybe that particular problem or that particular question.
That probably helps with creativity as well, because by tapping into these different disciplines, you're generating cognitive diversity. So you're surrounding yourself with people who are dealing with not only just design problems, but also engineering problems as well, and promoting cross-pollination of ideas, which I'm sure can also boost creativity and spark new insights. Looking back on your career as a manager, what stands out to you as one of the most valuable failures you had, and what makes it valuable?
From a people perspective, I would say one of the first examples that came to mind is the path of helping someone else realize whether or not they want to be a manager. Early on in my career, you know, I thought that, oh, you know, being a manager is so great that it's clearly the step up in career path for everyone. And so if I had a high performing person on my team, you know, an individual contributor, a really, really talented designer, someone that other people look to naturally as a leader, you know, I'd suggest it to that person, hey, you know, like you would be a great manager. Why don't you come in and, you know, manage a part of the team? And, you know, I thought that I was really being helpful. I thought that would be great for that person. I thought it would be great for our team. The problem is, not everyone is a great fit for being a manager. And it's not because they don't have the skills or the authority or the qualities of being a great leader. It's just that management is a very specific role and not everyone likes to do that role. And I've made this mistake, you know, once with this, like I said, this really brilliant IC, you know, our team needed someone to scale. I asked this person to become the manager. They said yes, because, you know, I think in retrospect, they didn't want to let me down and they wanted to help the team. But this is a person who was so creative, who loved nothing more than to have long stretches of interrupted time to focus deeply on a problem. You know, this person was a craftsperson. This person was someone who did amazing design work. And when they were in that position of being a manager, when, you know, they had to have one-on-ones every day and go from meeting to meeting and didn't really like have time to actually go deep on a problem and instead had to kind of, you know, help other people direct, it made that person deeply unhappy. Eventually, one day they were burnt out and they told me that they needed to leave the team.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me, because I value uninterrupted periods of deep work as well. And I mean, I do manage people, but certainly not at a corporation. And I can see how, even though the management is viewed as a promotion, you're absolutely right that it's not going to be the right fit for some people. So for this person, it actually probably felt like a demotion.
Yes. And that taught me a really important lesson, that it's really important to ensure that if someone is interested in management, or even if you think someone might be great for management, that they have to feel like it's a good fit, that they have to be interested for the reasons that are ultimately going to make them happy and fulfilled in their career. And that doesn't mean just looking at it like, oh, it's a prestigious thing, or, oh, you know, there's a title, there's a great title associated with it. But it's really focusing on, hey, do we understand what this job is about? Do we understand, you know, what qualities would make someone more or less interested in doing this job? And have we thought about that? Have we had that conversation?
Now, you mentioned there were a few valuable failures that jumped to mind. You mentioned one of them. Can you share one or two others?
One of, I think, my biggest lessons in my development as a designer. Many years ago, we were looking to redesign Facebook. There's a lot of really good reasons for why we wanted to redesign the website. We had been around for a few years, and the trends in web design was going in a direction where content was a lot more immersive. We were seeing a lot more larger photos, richer media. Partly it was because camera phones were out and digital camera quality was getting better. And so, you know, the resolution of photos being supported was higher. We had designed the original website back in 2006, again, when the web was a lot more text heavy, and there was less imagery because of bandwidth and all of those other issues. And so we wanted to turn it into something that was a lot more rich, immersive, visual. You know, this was a perfect project for my team, all of us designers. We were so excited to work on this, you know, and to, you know, put our heads together and develop what we thought was an incredible vision, you know, something that was extremely modern, extremely cutting edge, and putting together like a beautiful website for Facebook. So we worked on this. We worked on this for 6 months or so. We built it. We were all playing with it internally. We loved it. It looked amazing on our screens at work. And we just loved the experience. And we assumed everybody else would love the experience. So one day we turned it on, you know, went out to the world, right? And, you know, Facebook at that time was hundreds of millions of people, still quite a lot of users. And we were just waiting for all the praise to come in, you know, people to tell us how much they love the experience. Unfortunately, we were in for a rude shock because a lot of people complained about it. And there were, you know, some people praised it, you know, like some of our friends and other tech companies in the Bay Area. But a lot of people wrote in and were like, wow, you changed this thing. I don't like it. Bring back old Facebook. And we thought to ourselves, you know, it's fine. It's not a big deal. Like a lot of times when you change things, you know, even if the change is for the better, it takes a while for people to get used to that change. And so let's just like write off this feedback and let's wait like a month or so. And I'm sure by then people will be used to it and they'll love it, right? They'll see this brilliant thing that we had created. But unfortunately, if you look at all of the metrics that we were tracking, all of the things that we were measuring to understand the health of how our website was performing, they were all bad. People started using Facebook less. People were looking at fewer, you know, stories. People were commenting and engaging with other people less. People were navigating less to all the other parts of the site. In fact, nothing was good. No metric was positive or could support a narrative that this was somehow for the better. And this was really, really hard for us to understand because it was so cognitively dissonant from our own experiences, and we didn't understand why. And we didn't want to roll it back until we understood why, because, you know, then it felt unprincipled, right? So then we embarked on a multi-month project to kind of tease apart all of the different changes that we had made. And again, because this was a big redesign, we had made tons of changes. Is it because we changed this font size? Is it because the feed story now is less inviting for commenting? We ended up going and trying to decompose everything to isolate, you know, what is it that is making this design not work? And we did that. And ultimately, we found the answer. The answer was that here in our company, in Silicon Valley, in, you know, the United States, we had all upgraded to much better equipment. You had large screens, we had fast computers, we were able to support all this rich imagery. But in most of the world, that was not the case. You know, they didn't have the large fancy screens, they didn't have like the latest cutting edge computers. And so our new redesign, which worked great on those systems, totally did not work. You know, it didn't, like the size of an image, again, we made it so big and immersive, didn't fit on the viewport of an average computer in any other country in the world. It turns out, you know, it actually was a way worse experience. You know, we got ourselves like one of those, you know, laptops. We went and did a lot more field research. And, you know, you couldn't, like, it was inarguable that design was not better in those contexts.
There is a principle in rocket science that this reminded me of called test as you fly, fly as you test. The idea is that when you're testing a spacecraft on Earth, when you're testing components, the test has to as closely resemble the flight as possible. And then the flight itself has to as closely resemble the test as possible. And what I'm hearing you say is that there was a disconnect here between the test and the flight, because you were using these advanced computers to test the website, the new design, but then the flight would be taking place on really old, slow computers, and so the experience would be very, very different.
It was a huge lesson for us, because it was then that we realized, you know, our user base is much beyond, you know, any of our own intuitions and our own experiences. And that, you know, that wasn't the case when we were small, right? And when we were small and, you know, we had only, you know, a few million users and all of them were college students, it felt like we could really intuit, you know, what is the best feature for this audience, because we were very much a part of that audience. We understood that audience well. And as we grew and as we became more and more of a global product used by many more people all across the world, we learned through this process that, you know, we had to trust our intuitions less and less, and we had to go out there and learn to be empathetic and to really connect with the users all across the world, and to trust basically, you know, maybe what we thought was good or what we liked less and less. And I think you need to do that, you know, to be a designer, or if you're building anything at scale for an audience, a large audience, or even an audience that's not yourself, you know, it's extremely important to develop that muscle that says, wait, let me assume that I have my own biases based on my experiences, based on, you know, where I live, based on, you know, what I have and what I know. And I need to park that somewhere, right? And it doesn't mean, you know, never trust your gut, but it does mean we have to do a lot more work to go out there and to put on that, you know, the hat that says, I'm going to listen, I'm going to observe, and I'm going to truly try and understand other people and this audience that I'm building for.
Right. Yeah, no, it's an exercise in empathy. You've written on your blog, and I believe this is in your book as well, which for those listening, so Julie's book, The Making of a Manager, What to Do When Everyone Looks to You, will have been released by the time this episode is published. So you can find that on, well, wherever books are sold. But you talk about the discomfort zone. What is the discomfort zone and why is it important?
The discomfort zone is, you know, as his name implies, it's basically the circle that's right outside of your comfort zone. It's when you're put in a new situation that you haven't been in before, that you're not exactly sure what you're doing. This is when, you know, imposter syndrome, as we were talking about earlier, is most likely to rear its ugly head. Your initial instinct is like, I don't know what I'm doing. Let me go back and like do the thing that I know how to do. And I think this zone is critical because this is where growth happens. It's where we learn to develop our skills and to get better in the thing that we're not used to. And I think it's critical for managers, because the whole point of being a manager is that, you know, you're trying to help a group of people get to better outcomes and to overcome problems and to do great work together. You're going to face challenges and you're going to face situations that you haven't been in before. And so the most important thing is learning the tools, right? Having the tools at your disposal to know how you can get past the discomfort zone. You know, again, it doesn't mean it's going to somehow be comfortable. It just means that you feel more confident that when you're in that situation, it's like you have your compass, you have a map, you know it's going to be messy, but you're going to figure it out.
The issue that I see, and I see this in myself as well as others, is when you get comfortable, you want to stay comfortable. and so over time, there is a tendency, a regression to complacency. Are there any strategies that you use to push yourself back outside of the comfort zone and back into the discomfort zone?
So two things I would say. The first is, I find this extremely powerful, is to take the time periodically. This could be once a month, this could be once every 6 months, maybe even once a year, to try and visualize, okay, if I look 1 or 2 years out, or if I look, you know, even 3 or 5 years out, what is that version of me that I want to be? Like, what's that, you know, ideal state? You know, if I think about where I would like to be in 3 years as it relates to my career, or it relates to my personal life or my hobbies or my goals, what do I hope is different then compared to where I am today? I think this is really powerful because, you know, it lets you dream and it lets you focus a little bit on understanding your values and understanding, you know, very intentionally where you would like your path to go. And once you have that image and once you've sort of sorted through that, then it just becomes a question of, okay, so if, you know, if I look at me in 3 years and how I want to be is I want to be much more confident. I want to be, let's say, a great public speaker. I want to be, you know, a manager that's able to connect much more deeply and have that kind of, you know, deep relationship with my ports. What has to, like, what's different, you know, like what do I need to do to get towards that? Like, what's the skill that I need to learn? What's the thing that I need to get better at? What's the area where I need to practice? And then that basically lays out kind of a path that you have to kind of start to take the first step towards if you want to get to that end state. And I find it is really helpful because it provides the motivation for why you might sign up for that speaking opportunity, even though it makes you really nervous, right? Because, you know, you're trying to actively work towards that skill and get to becoming a great public speaker. And it gives you that kind of push to look for those little opportunities and to find little ways to get out of your comfort zone.
Now, is this something you do on a regular basis in terms of looking to the future and seeing yourself 5 years, 10 years from now? And then working back from that, I believe somewhere I read that you maintain a one day I will list. Is this related to that or is that something else?
Definitely. It is related to that. But I also do, you know, at the start of every year, so I sit down and I think about my resolutions and, you know, that's the same exercise I go to. I think about where I want to be at the end of the year and I want to look back and think, wow, that was a really fulfilling year. That was a year where I learned a lot. Okay, what are those things that I want to learn? And I write them down. And then I have the like one day I will list, you know, and it helps me because let's say I had a day where maybe I had some frustrations and I felt like, you know, I was in a meeting and I didn't make a point that I wanted to make and therefore we didn't get the outcome that I wanted and, you know, I lost that battle, right? And I found it was motivating to just keep track of that on the list, like, you know, to just see like, you know, one day I'm going to be really, really great at making that point and being persuasive, you know, and just, you know, taking all of those failures that I feel and just reminding myself that it doesn't have to be this way forever, that one day I will practice these skills and I will get better. And it's powerful to kind of read that list and to, you know, again, I've kept this for the last 10 years and over those 10 years, things have been checked off and that feels really good, you know, that there is that growth and, you know, there's tons of stuff still on the list and things that I'm adding, you know, all the time now, but the fact that time and effort make a difference, you know, to the goals that you have, it is rewarding to see the historical context of that.
Sure. And I love that exercise too as a way of putting a positive spin on failure as well. Relatedly, so there's a tweet you sent out on, this is back in June 2018, which I'm going to read out loud and then I'd love to hear you give us some context on this. But you said, my mom once remarked that I didn't really seem to apply myself when there was not pressure of a test, competition, etc. But that if there is one thing I've learned is that the best results don't come from fear. Can you give us some context to that quote?
Yes, that's really funny. And you just reminded me of a whole swath of other things from my childhood. So I grew up in an Asian immigrant family. My family is Chinese. We moved here when I was 5 or 6 years old. And so for us, you know, being here is the American dream. And therefore, my parents, you know, kind of had a tendency to be tiger parents, right? And, you know, they were like, we're here. Like, Julie, you need to get good grades. You need to, like, go to a great college. You need to have a stable job. Like, you know, this is the opportunity for you to have, you know, this great life, you know. And we came to this country so that we would have the opportunity to do that because, you know, we weren't going to be able to have that where we came from. And so I felt that pressure growing up a lot that, you know, I was here, my parents had sacrificed so much and that it was really important that, you know, I had got great grades and that, you know, and each of these things kind of became like a test, right? It's like a little, like a moment where I had to, you know, demonstrate what I could do and just over and win and get that A and cross the hurdle. And, you know, that was a lot of like my mentality growing up and how I saw the world. But, you know, I got past college and got into the real world and realized actually the real world, there aren't so many of these like clear cut tests. You know, you don't have grades anymore. You don't have like, here's the next hoop to jump through because it was like about middle school to college, you know, to high school to college. And I had to sort of learn how to find my own way, right? And my own passion and what was going to be motivating to me that came from myself. And I realized that there was a lot of rewards to doing that and to understanding that. And it was hard, you know, it was something where I struggled with for a time, where I felt like, hey, but there aren't anything, if there wasn't like a clear path laid out for me, like, what am I going to do? How am I going to measure, you know, where I want to be? But through that process, you know, this is where I kind of reflected on spending a lot more time on trying to understand, who is that person I want to be? What's the thing that I, you know, when I'm 80 years old, I want to say that I've done in this world? Or, you know, and what are the values that I hold most dear, kind of like over the course of many years? And even today, you know, I still feel like I'm learning more and more about myself and all of those things that I hold dear.
Well, Julie, this was such a fun conversation. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. If people are interested in learning more about you, where can they find you online?
They can find me on Twitter. My handle is at @JOULEE. I also have a website at my name, juliezhuo.com. My last name's a little hard to spell. It's Z-H-U-O. I post, you know, podcasts that I'm on, articles that I've written. There's a link to my blog. There's information about the book. And of course, my book, The Making of a Manager, comes out March 19th. It's an all, you know, everything you need to know field guide for first-time or early career managers that addresses kind of practical everyday advice, like how to manage your own emotions when you don't know what's going on, how to have a one-on-one, how to have effective meetings that everyone actually wants to attend, and you know, how to hire great talent, how to have hard conversations. So it covers a wide spectrum.
Excellent. Well, we'll have links to the book and everything else that Julie mentioned in the show notes, so you can check them out. Julie, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.